Hi there. All right. Is this really spring? Close? Yes. Okay. From now on, studying becomes impossible, right? Oh well. Questions? Problems? Curiosities? Right. You went to the course, HDFS 60, on the course reserves? Yeah. Then the problem is that for some reason the library system doesn't list things by author on the course reserves, which is absolutely absurd since we all refer to things by author. So what you will do is get a list of things by title. And on the syllabus, the listings are by author and date. And there's another page in the syllabus that lists all the readings by author and title. So you have to make the translation from what's listed. If you're looking for Bronfenbrenner 1983, then you have to go to the sheet that has Bronfenbrenner 1983 and find out what the title is and then pull it up on the reserves. I'm sorry? Number 4 and number 16. Okay. Let's see, and titles are alphabetical, is that the deal?
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, it's just one of those little things where whoever developed the software for the reserve system was not an academic. It was a software engineer, right? Instead of being an academic, and an academic would have known that things are always listed by author. Everything is listed by author. And I raised the issue a couple of years ago with the library system, and I got some... Well, actually, immediately after I raised the question, the course reserve director retired. So I haven't raised it with Eric yet, the new one. But anyway, there was some noise about what it would cost to revise the software, so it won't happen. But I could maybe make it clearer on the syllabus. Make a note and change that before you retire. All right. Other issues, questions? You mean I just get to have fun? Okay. I'm going to have fun. The discussion about ending relationships last Wednesday reminded me of some research that I like to talk about. And so I'm going to talk about that today after I make sure that we're really recording this, which we are. What would be your intuitive understanding? Should you have just one important relationship before you get married? Or is it the more you practice, the better you get? How many of you think you ought to marry your first love? Okay. How many of you think the more practice you get, the better your relationships will be? Okay. You're right up to a point. Up to a point. Let me talk about the point. A fellow at the University of Minnesota named Andy Collins has been studying relationships as they develop during adolescence and beyond. Andy's a child psychologist with a specialty in adolescence. And he got interested in romantic relationships. And as part of a seminar that he was doing, he reviewed the literature and said, you know what? We don't really know much about how romantic relationships develop during adolescence and what happens to them and what impact they have. He discovered that most of the textbooks refer to a very few studies which are fairly old and not very informative. So a number of years ago, he set up a sample in which he recruited young adolescents into a study that he intended to keep going for a number of years and does keep going. It's been now about 12, 14 years. And what he did was start by interviewing people, early adolescents, about their dating and about the relationships that they developed. And then he recruited their dating partners into the relationship whenever he could so that he could interview them separately and together about the relationship and what it meant to them, and just kept a log of the dating history for each of these subjects in the study. And when they broke up, as most do, he would then keep both partners in the study and ask them to continue, and when they started dating somebody else, he would recruit their new dating partners into the study. So it's kind of like a mushroom, and just keeps growing. But now he's able to talk about and write about what happens across adolescence because he's following these people as they go into and through college and looking at their relationships. The study has gotten quite out of hand with the number of people in it, but he's got lots of money to support it and lots of graduate students, so they keep going. He says at some point it's just all going to implode with the vast numbers of people. But his goal now is to continue following people as they marry and follow them through. He said he never thought he would be doing marriage research, but that's where he's going because some of his subjects have gotten married. And so last time I talked with him, I told him, good, now you can start doing divorce research. And you can look at the relationship history that leads into marriage and then through. He says, nah, my subjects won't get divorced. Yeah, they will. They are. So what he's been doing is following people and looking at the intensity of the relationships, what percentage of time people are involved in a partnered relationship, and he has the full range from people who never have a dating partner during high school, you know, as some of you went through high school without ever having a boyfriend or girlfriend. He's got some of those in the sample. He's got others who've had one and continue that one into college, where most of them break up, particularly if they're long-distance relationships. And then he's got some who've just never been without a partner and have dated dozens of people. And what he's interested then is what happens, what do you learn in each relationship and each breakup, and what are the characteristics of those relationships that promote development. So it's an interesting kind of study, but this is the piece that I wanted to talk about. And part of the fun of this is that when he first presented these results, he didn't know quite what to make of them. And so he invited a group of us to sit down over lunch one day and brainstorm what was really going on with his subjects, because he had come into it assuming that as you have experience, your relationships should get better. And he was finding that that was true for some of his subjects, but it was not true of the people who had the most experience. And he wasn't quite sure what to make of that. But what he discovered was that the people who spent the most time partnered up through high school and into college not only did not have the best relationships, their relationships got worse. Their relationships got worse. And this is the way we made sense out of the data. If you watch the history, for some people, they enter a relationship, that relationship goes on, and then they break up. Then there's a period of time when they are single, then they enter another relationship. And when that one ends, there's a period of time, and I'm making them look like they're all the same length, but they're highly variable. If you plot the quality of the relationship as the satisfaction of both partners, their rating of the communication that they have in it, how intimate the relationship is, not sexually, but interpersonally intimate, how pleased they are in the dating relationship. What you plot is a steady increase in the quality of those relationships. The ones that declined looked like this. And a couple of things happened. One was that as people went through adolescence, their relationships got shorter. And if you plotted relationship quality, there was a steady decline to the point where, with some of his subjects, he had to begin to warn them that he was obligated to report if they were dating somebody who was older than they, or if they were the older partner, he was obligated to report abuse because they were not yet 18. What he was seeing was increasing dissatisfaction and threat and eventually the potential for violence and some violence within the relationships. And as he was initially looking at the data, he was saying, well, this person has had 3 relationships, this person has had 7. 7 is more than 3, so it ought to be more experience. And why are the relationships becoming less in their quality? And what appears to be happening, you can probably tell me. What's happening? What's happening in these relationships? Why are they different? Okay, so one possibility, and there are a number here, is that the shorter relationships, as they get shorter, you're not learning as much, you're not resolving issues, and you're moving on. Okay. So these periods are reflection time and regrouping, figuring out what went on in the relationship, and maybe that's when you develop the skills or consolidate the skills or figure out that you want to go into your next relationship slightly differently, perhaps more intelligently than you did. Okay, so maybe these people who are not taking reflection time between are motivated by desperation. They have to be in a relationship. They're not comfortable being on their own, and they're not learning to be because they never are. So they're going from one relationship to another because they really need to have a relationship, or they really want to have a relationship and aren't comfortable being by themselves. Other options? Other possibilities?
What if, like, while you're in a relationship with somebody else, you develop a relationship with somebody else?
Ah. Okay, so one of the options is that these people are actually not being psychologically faithful in these relationships, so that they're actually looking around, and that's why they're able to jump to another relationship so quickly, because they're not putting the time and energy into these relationships in the first place. Their interest is in attracting somebody new, finding somebody new. So instead of the growth that's happening in the relationships where the quality is improving, instead of that happening in these relationships, the problems or issues lead you to dump the person. That's an interesting question. I'll have to go back and ask Andy and his data. He does have information about the decision to end each relationship. And that's not something we talked about, whether these are ended differently. So it may be that some people are ending relationships because they're jumping to another one, but they're not putting together the skills. Their skill is attracting a new mate, rather than the skill of being in a relationship. Okay. I think all of those are probably true, and I think they're probably going on here. The piece that intrigues me most is the importance of the reflection time. That as you end a relationship, you spend time not partnered up, learning whatever you can about being alone, so that then you take a better you into the next relationship. You have time to consolidate what you learned, you have time to develop new skills, you have time to broaden your interests, you have time to figure out that you're okay without a partner. And then you can go into a new relationship with your eyes open, not desperate for the relationship. I think all of those pieces are happening. The other characteristic of these relationships was that the partners who were chosen were less likely to be skilled as you were having relationships close together and the quality was going down. The potential of the partners to have a good relationship with you was going down. As relationship quality goes up, even if you're moving to a new relationship, the skills of the partner are also likely to be increasing. Unless you're one of the temporary victims of the person who's having multiple relationships very quickly. So here, in the declining relationship quality group, the potential partners, the partners you're choosing, are not as good candidates for developing a good relationship. So you're attracting people more like yourself as your relationship skills decline. Okay. The take-home message when you break up: spend that reflection time. Take time out. Don't jump into a new relationship immediately until you've figured out what went wrong. Look around. Heal enough so that you aren't desperate, and so that you're not choosing a partner on the basis of being wounded. So you take somebody who's whole and strong into that new relationship. Many of us look for comfort in relationship. This is true for marriage as well. Andy's not looking at marriages yet. But if you look at the pattern of people who've been married and divorced, there are people who do the same thing. There are people who wait, begin dating slowly, marry considerably later. The people who marry very quickly, especially if they're marrying a partner that they've already picked out, or had an affair with, if the dating has started within the previous relationship, those relationships are much less likely to last. People are moving into those relationships because they don't know how to be on their own, and they're not comfortable being on their own. So, first take-home lesson is, don't jump into a new relationship immediately. Give yourself time to figure out what went wrong. Regroup. Become whole and not needy, so you're not grieving for the past relationship. That doesn't mean no dating. It means not getting into a committed relationship. And the second take-home message is, if you're looking for a partner, the person who's just come out of a relationship might really need you and really treat you well, and you might feel really helpful taking care of somebody who's still grieving an old relationship. Uncle Larry says, don't do it. Be a friend, encourage them, go to the movies, but don't get in a committed relationship with them, because they haven't learned what they need to learn. On a practical level, practical means it comes out of my own experience dating as a divorced person. One of the guidelines that was very useful was, if a person can't have dinner with you and not talk about their ex-partner, this is a warning sign. You need to be able to talk about something else other than the breakup of their marriage. And they need to be able to talk, when they do talk about the previous relationship, it is helpful if the person can talk about that relationship without blaming the ex. If a person is able to take responsibility for what went wrong in their previous relationship and acknowledge that it's a transaction that two people are involved in, then that person is perhaps reasonable material for a relationship, a reasonable partner. But if the person is still blaming everything on the old partner and not seeing it as something that he or she put into as well, you don't want to get involved with them. Right. I'll accept that. Certainly you should not trust my experience. On the other hand, it's universal because everybody I've ever talked to shares that account. It does take, knowing about relationships does take some of the romance, some of the thrill, but not very much of it, out of the process. And the problem is that romance will get you burned. The more you know about relationships and how they develop, and the more you know about the skills, the smarter you can be about the choices that you make, is my sense. People probably can learn what they need to know without spending time doing it, but I'm dubious. And if you're assessing the potential of the person that you're getting to know, if you're assessing that person's potential, one of the pieces I think that's important is that the person is available and does have relationship skills. And a person who is blaming the ex or hung up on the old relationship is probably not really available emotionally. That person will eventually become available through the relationship with you if you choose to have them, have a relationship with them. Your transactions may be very helpful to helping them heal. And so it's not an indication that you should never do that, but you need to be aware that once the person has healed and has figured out and learned what he or she needs to know, you may not be that person's partner of choice. And some of us spend a lot of time picking up the pieces when people say, well, I helped him through his, and it's often a him, helped him through his divorce, and I was there for him, and we had a wonderful life together, and he promised me everything, and then he dumped me. And that happens often enough that you keep that red flag up there. The first person is a healing relationship, and many of us don't make a commitment long term to our nurses or our doctors. Once you figure out, hey, I'm okay now, then it's time to play the field a little bit. Time to explore who else is out there. So you thank the person who's helped you through it, and then you move on. And if you're expecting that, that's fine. But if you're expecting a lifetime commitment from somebody who's just out of a relationship, it's helpful to know that the probability of that is low. Statistically, it's a low probability. Second marriages are more likely to end in divorce than first marriages, and the sooner they happen after the first marriage ends, the sooner they happen, the higher the probability. And if there are children, it goes up even higher. Again, what that suggests is that the time to sort out how to be a human being and then how to be a partner is crucial. Another piece that's important, if you're talking about divorce, if there are children, this is a period of time when people are figuring out how to be a parent. And if you get in the middle of that, you are interfering with the process of the person becoming a parent. And you may end up being resented by children because you're interfering with their parent being a parent. Uncle Larry gives advice. He doesn't really expect people to follow it. But when they don't, he gets to say, well, that was predictable, wasn't it? Okay. Are there questions about that or about breaking up? Well, if it's a happy marriage, it's a good thing. Right. But what does it mean? How do you explain it? People have been in a relationship, they broke up for whatever reason, then they've gone on and had more experience.
Is that their
It's reflection and experience time and constructing better skills and becoming more mature. And then you can figure out that, hey, you know, the chemistry is still good and whatever attracted us to each other in the first place is still there, and we're grown-ups now. So we may have learned wonderful things together. My favorite example of that, I wish I had the interview on tape. I may have talked about it in here before. I wonder if I could get them on tape. Anyway, I had a student in HDFS5 many years ago, who was divorced and remarried to the same person. And often people will remarry and re-divorce the same person. It's that going in and out of the same relationship, trying to get it right, and it doesn't work. But when it does work, it's wonderful. In this particular case, the couple got married shortly after high school. They had two or three children. They were together 8 or 10 years, and they decided they couldn't be together anymore. And because they were from the same town and they knew each other's families and had forever, they spent a lot of time at family functions, and for the sake of the children, they made sure that they were civil to each other. And they did that for 8 or 10 years, and they both dated other people. They both had relationships with other people. And one night, they had been at a birthday party, I believe it was, for one of the kids who was in his teens, and they were talking, and they had reached the point in their post-divorce relationship that most of us get to, which is being able to sit down with our ex and laugh about what's happened to us, sometimes laugh about what happened in the marriage, sometimes laugh about some of the stupid things that we did while we were divorcing, and most importantly, be able to laugh about some of the things that we've done since we got divorced, and then cry about some of those things. And in this particular case, this couple were sitting on the back steps of the house talking about a relationship. One of them had just broken up in a relationship, and the other one was saying, "So, you know, what'd you learn this time?" And they got into a discussion of what they had each learned in relationships, both good and bad, and some of the experiences that they had had. And the conversation turned to what they had learned, how they had grown up in the 8 or 10 years since their divorce, and how they saw themselves now. And they realized that they were talking about what was wrong in their marriage. And as they did that, they realized they had both come to understand that it was a marriage that was too young. They didn't have the skills. They hadn't had enough experience. What had happened to them after the divorce was they had grown up and they had developed some of the skills that they wished they had in their marriage. And as they were talking about that, they were kind of doing the nostalgia bit of, you know, I wish we had known these things when we were married. Maybe we wouldn't have gotten divorced. And being intelligent people, they said, "Huh, gosh, I still like you, and you're a great parent. You're still kind of cute. Maybe we could have dinner sometime without the kids, without our in-laws, without the grandparents." So they did, and they started dating. And they were, you know, we got to be very cautious about this. And then they dated, and then they realized that all of the chemistry that had attracted them to each other when they were 17 and 18 was still there. And they had the same kids and a lot of the same interests, so they eventually remarried. And the last time I saw her, they're still happily married. When I saw her last, I said, "So, how did the second divorce go?" And she laughed and threatened to hit me. Said, "There's not going to be a second divorce. They just got married too soon, didn't have enough experience, and had learned what they needed to learn. And we're back in a very happy relationship." And the occasion for seeing her the last time was that their youngest child just graduated from UVM last year, so I get to see her. So it works if people are able to use their experience and can come to an understanding of how to have a relationship. They have a great deal of shared history. They have shared kids. There are all kinds of things in common, and for some people it works. For others, there's no way in heck you could possibly be married to the same person that you're divorced from. It just, there's no way it would work. And those are usually situations where people, if they're being honest, will acknowledge that they never really loved each other. It wasn't that they didn't have the skills. They were the people who knew, usually very early on, that the relationship wasn't appropriate. One of the things I love to do, and you can do this with your parents if you'd like, ask them how they felt, if they're divorced. No, if they're together too. Ask them how they felt on their wedding day. What were you thinking deep down in your heart? And many divorced people will acknowledge that they were thinking, this is the stupidest thing I have done ever in my life, but I don't know how to get out of it. That's a very common story. And people who are happily married say, I had qualms, but I knew I wanted to be married to the other parent, to my partner. And sometimes what happens is that people know they shouldn't be doing this, but the wedding juggernaut is in motion, and there is a caterer, and there is a reception hall, and there is a $500 to $20,000 dress, and there are invitations, and it is going to happen. And what happens is that brides and grooms, the day before that juggernaut comes to a climax, is that people say, I don't want to do this. And when you express that to other people, they will inevitably say, everybody feels that way. Don't worry about it. That is people who are certain that they want to be married and are completely comfortable with the partner and are old enough to make that decision don't have any doubts. They know this is what I ought to be doing, this is what I want to be doing, there are no cold feet. If you have cold feet, people will tell you, everybody has them, but that's not true. They will also tell you, you have to go through with this because I'll kill you if you don't. That's the parent speaking. And what would we do? We would lose all this money, everybody would be embarrassed, you can't do that to us. That's the point when you probably ought to do it. Or, don't show up. Or, write your divorce agreement. Or, use your honeymoon to schedule your couples counseling, so that you can get it off on the right foot. Okay. I have to quote another person that I interviewed at length. She said she had gone through that experience with her mother telling her that everybody felt that way, and her father telling her that if she backed out now, he'd kill her. His exact words, I'll kill you. You can't embarrass me that way. You can't embarrass yourself. It'll all work out fine. Two kids later, she described herself as sitting in the living room watching her husband. They'd been married by this time about 5 years. And she said, I realized I loathed him. There was nothing about him that I liked. And she said, I called a therapist the next day, spent a year in counseling, knowing that I was out of there. And she did. She left him. Enough said. It won't happen to you because you'll be smart enough not to get into that situation. It's also a rationale for having a very small, informal, inexpensive wedding. So you can decide not to do it. And does it work if one person has much more experience than the other? If one is in his or her first or second significant relationship and the other has had a lot of experience, in Collins' data, I'm not sure what he's finding, but that would be one place to answer it. What would you expect? What would you expect? Mm-hmm. So that suggests that they may have very different skills at maintaining a relationship and developing it. And that to me seems to be to be the important part. Do they have similar levels of maturity? Maybe not experience, but maturity in relationship, in communication, in emotional maturity. Can they enter a relationship as relative equals in terms of maturity? Or does one of them have a lot more experience and the other one is pretty naive and incompetent? And if the relationship skills are very unequal, then A, I'm not sure why they would be getting into the relationship. Murray Bowen says that's not very likely. That if you have a lot of relationship skill and emotional maturity, you're not going to have a relationship with somebody who's immature and unsophisticated because they're going to be more like a child to you. On the other hand, the panache and skill and sophistication of the more experienced person might be very attractive to somebody who's naive. It might also be intimidating. But there are all kinds of ways those kinds of relationships could go in many different directions, and I don't really have any data that I can draw on for that. You? Yeah. Absolutely. Is it possible to learn the skills together? Yes, that's what relationships are about, learning the skills together. And that's why some people who start dating at 14 and never date anybody else and get married at 21 celebrate their 75th wedding anniversaries when they're in their 90s. No. You don't have to have a lot of experience. What you have to be able to do is develop those skills with the partner and do that in a way that strengthens the relationship and lets you both grow up, or not develop those skills and be happy not having them together, which may lead to what Gottman calls volatile relationships. You know, people who don't have a lot of relationship skill but love each other very much and fight all the time and stay together. People do that. I don't, but it's exciting for some people. Some people have to keep the temperature turned way up in their relationships, and they do that by picking fights. You know, sometimes fighting and making up is when you have the best sex, the most passion, because you've gotten all the adrenaline going, you've cleared the air, you've fought with each other, and you take all that passion that you can't generate at other times. You know, you can't just, okay, it's 6 o'clock, honey. Let's go make passionate love. Duh. So some people discover that when you're fighting, you can turn that energy, the interpersonal energy of a fight, you can turn that into very passionate lovemaking. And some people thrive on that. They pick fights specifically so they can do that. You look at the pattern and you want to help them stop fighting, and if you actually help them stop fighting, they'd stop having sex and get divorced. As long as they don't hurt each other, it's nobody's business but theirs. What does it do?
Yeah.
What's the danger of casual dating over a long period of time? Some of you have done it. What happens? You get bored. Why? Same thing, but with different people. Isn't that exciting? No. Okay, so you get bored because in the first few dates you do the same thing. You give each other your history. You talk about your mesosystem. You talk about your macrosystem a little bit. You compare and contrast. You find out what the other person is like. And then you do that with somebody else. And then you do that with somebody else. And you do that with somebody else. And at some point, you want something else to happen. Right? You want somebody to care enough to call you back. Or go out of his way to get in touch with you. You want somebody to send you flowers. Or to say, gee, I really missed you. And in casual dating, that doesn't happen. So casual dating has as its danger that you get bored or dissatisfied because we all want, most of us want, more connection than we get in casual dating. So it's okay to do casual dating for all of adolescence and between relationships. Casual dating is fun. It lets you find out who's out there. Another danger some of you've experienced, if you're casually dating, after a while, what does mom say? What does your aunt say?
When are you going to get married?
When you get married. But if you're casually dating, if you're not dating at all, then they get really upset. Okay, what's wrong with you? If you're casually dating, and they fix you up with everybody they know, and you casually date them, you get to know them, and you say they're nice, but then what does mom say eventually? What does Aunt Charlie say? Now, what's wrong with you? You're too picky. You're too picky. You're too picky. Or, the psychologist says, you're afraid of getting involved. There's got to be something wrong with you if you're casually dating. You're too picky. You're afraid to get involved. You need therapy. Whatever. But casual dating is fun for a while. Some people take that casual dating and add sex to it. So it becomes recreational sex. One night stands, casual sex, and that has its own dangers. But eventually that becomes unsatisfying too, because what you really want is the intimacy of a relationship and mattering to somebody and having somebody call you up and say, I really missed you. Can you not, I like your body, but hey, you're a really cool person. I've liked watching you develop and you're really good for me. And so, I love you. You kind of want that. Most of us want to be lovable at some point. K. Francis Shepp, who used to direct the counseling center here, used to say that the issue in the teens is, am I attractive? The issue in the 20s is, am I lovable? So I try to get somebody to say, I love you. And in the 30s, it's, can I have a relationship that lasts? And those are different issues, the developmental stages. I'm not sure about the teens, 20s, 30s designation, but they are clearly different concerns that people have in relationship. Eventually, we cohabit. We've already talked about cohabiting. Then we decide we want that something else, right? Which is a dog. We want a dog. Or maybe a child. There is a normative set of expectations a set of normative expectations about what people do when they are coupled. And those normative expectations are described by Erickson and all kinds of other people in talking about relationship development. But at some point, commitment in the relationship is typically valued, and often having the dog or having a child or having children or doing something that is generative, in Erickson's terminology, you want to leave something for the future, or create something and nurture something. Those become important, so people do silly things like say, "Will you marry me?" and get the wedding juggernaut in motion. What you get is a decision. Now, we're going to do this in the traditional way. We're going to get married and then we're going to become parents. Does anybody have the most recent statistics on the number of brides that are pregnant? What? It made you laugh. Okay. It's a very high percentage, and it's probably higher than you would anticipate, of people who are pregnant, and that's why they decide to get married. And that number is increasing. Cohabitation leads to marriage often through pregnancy. And it's fascinating to me that some people see that as absolutely scandalous, when in many other cultures, there would be no reason to marry if you weren't pregnant. Some cultures actually have engagement or betrothal ceremonies. You know, we do. You have a ring. We announce to everybody that we're engaged. And then the couple starts having sex. And if they get pregnant, then they marry. Because the reason for marriage is to raise children. And there would be no point in marrying if you couldn't have children. So in many cultures, betrothal is the commitment, as it is here with engagement, and then the pregnancy, and the pregnancy then says, all right, let's get us married. And in other cultures that don't do it that way, you have the betrothal and then the marriage, and then if you don't get pregnant, you can leave the marriage without a problem. You have certain period of time, and after a while, if it's not happening, then the marriage has not been consummated, so you can leave it. And divorce is fairly automatic and painless. Except that in those cultures, the woman is the one who always gets blamed. Because in those cultures, you don't have sperm tests to find out if the man is the one who's not getting you pregnant. So, you have a decision to marry or unite. We typically have some kinds of vows, but you don't have to. Some of you know what the vows are. Some of you could probably recite them for me right now. How many of you have thought about your wedding, the one you expect to have? How many of you know what your dress is going to look like? Have planned the music? When did you start planning it? 14? Sixteen? Anybody want to go lower? Five? Sure, you start doing that. Okay, guys, how many of you have rehearsed your wedding and know what you're going to wear? It's a woman's world. Men seem to rarely do that. I rarely have students who say, yeah, I started thinking about that when I was 14 or 16. Women seem to do that. My nephew summed it up really well. After he proposed, he did propose, So it was a decision. And his wife started immediately sitting down with her mother and her sister planning the wedding. And somebody said, is Jeremy involved in these discussions? And Jeremy looked up and said, I've told them what I want. Okay. And his mother, my sister, said, what do you want? He said, I want them to tell me where to be, what to wear, and what to say. That's it. That's the end of planning. It's their thing. And he was perfectly happy. The fun part was, they did have a really fun wedding. We had a great time, except that they kind of changed when it was going to happen and where it was going to happen. And so there we were in Florida, and they didn't have a... They wanted everybody to have, you know, rehearsal dinner, but there are 25 people wandering around Daytona because nobody had made reservations on a Friday night in Daytona. So we finally found a place that would accommodate 25 people. And I watched, everything runs late, right? So I'm on the motel balcony, it's going to be outside. I watched the mother of the bride run to her car about 10 minutes after the wedding procession has supposed to start, and music hasn't started, so we're all standing around drinking. Mother of the bride gets in her car, peels out. And I figure, okay, this is over. She's had it. She's gone. She's never going to show up. 20 minutes later, back in, skids to a halt, jumps out. She had gone home to get the rings, which they had forgotten. So we have a wonderful picture of the bride. You have to show it. Looking around a corner, trying to tell people, that's the wrong music! It was a great marriage. It is still a great marriage. They are happily married. Legally, there are no vows. You do not have to, in Vermont, promise anything. You have to attest to the justice of the peace or anybody else who can sign the papers. You have to affirm that you are doing this of your own free will and nobody is coercing you to do this. That's it. Then you sign the paper and you're married. That's it. You don't even have to have witnesses. Vermont is really, really simple. Then you get to take on the role. You create the relational marriage that you've been talking about. Husband, wife, spouse, how you're going to do this, what those roles are going to be. And convince other people that you're married. I must tell a story about my own. My wife and I got married at Klinger's, and a friend of ours who's a justice of the peace signed the papers. We bought her a cappuccino. Two of our friends heard about the fact that we were going to get married, so they crashed and witnessed it. I made them buy their own cappuccino. And then we had a party in the evening and had 68 people and fed them and exchanged our vows and our rings. No clergy, no nothing. We just did. We're grown-ups. We can do this. I don't need somebody else to tell me what to say. So we did our own thing. And then we invited everybody to eat. And my father-in-law hadn't gotten word. In fact, I forgot to say that we had gotten married in the morning. I forgot to say it. So we didn't tell anybody. And he looked up and said, is that legal? Can they do that? Just marry themselves? He didn't realize that we'd done it in the morning. So I had to apologize. Started off my marriage on a good foot with my father-in-law, who thought I was scofflaw. You have to get the other people to understand that you're married, to accept that, to stop asking you for dates. Okay? Very important. Once somebody gets married, you're not supposed to ask them for dates. You have to tell everybody around that now you own property jointly. Change your name if you want. It's up to you. You don't have to. In Vermont or most other states, you can use any name you want in Vermont as long as you're not trying to defraud. And then here's the rub. There's where the rubber hits the road. And in Vermont, you buy the license to marry. And then you get somebody who's authorized, like a justice of the peace, a clergy person, a judge, to hear that you're doing this of your own free will, and the three of you sign the form, and then you're married. That's all there is to it. What they don't tell you is that you have just put yourself under about 75 laws that apply to married people. There is no listing that's handed to you with the license. I'd love to have somebody do that. Okay, if you sign this license as a couple or a civil union, everything that applies to marriage in Vermont also applies to civil union. All of these laws are going to be in effect. They're going to affect you. There is a whole raft of rights and privileges and responsibilities that come along with having signed that piece of paper and filing it with the town clerk. You have the obligation to support the other person. You have the obligation to pay the other person's debts. You have the obligation to jointly agree to borrow money. You can't take out a mortgage if you're married or civil union without the signature of the other person, because that person is going to be obligated. All of the restrictions on credit, contracts, debts, insurance, pensions, Social Security, your retirement income, inheritance, taxes, all of those are different for single or cohabiting people than they are for married or civilly unioned people. The other person is very, very tightly woven into your financial life forever. Not just now, not just until you divorce. If you stay married at least 10 years, if it's at least 10 years, it's forever, even if you divorce. So, for example, what they haven't told you is that when you divorce after having been married 10 years, your ex-spouse is entitled to choose to draw Social Security benefits on your account, even after you're divorced, or his or her own, whichever gives the highest amount. And if he or she does draw on your account, your benefits are reduced.
What about if they remarry?
If they remarry, they lose that option after they are remarried for 10 years. Yes. Yeah. Take anything I say about the legal aspects of it with a block of salt. I'm not a lawyer. I don't give legal advice. I just warn people what they're getting into. If you are married, even if you've only been married for a day, and have a pension plan, you got this money set aside for your retirement. 50% of it must go to your spouse. You can't give it to your children or other people without giving 50% of it or more to your spouse, unless your spouse signs a form that says he or she is aware of that and
happily or unhappily agrees and understands this. So you can't get rid of your money, even if you put that money away before you got married. I'm sorry? A prenuptial agreement would not change the legal obligation. It would include signing the form that says. No. No. Federal benefits cannot be affected by a prenuptial agreement. The law doesn't allow you to change the law. It allows you to make choices when they are within the law. But Social Security doesn't care what your prenuptial agreement said. It cares only who you are and how long you were married. Yep.
And can they do that?
A pension. Social Security, no. A pension, yes. What happens when you have, for example, I have TIAA, Teachers Insurance Annuity Association, which is a mutual fund-based retirement plan. When I retire, I take that money and I annuitize it. It means I buy a plan that will pay me then for the rest of my life. I have choices when I make that election, it's called. And I can choose one life for, say, guaranteed for 10 years. And that means that the amount will be based on the actuarial expectation of my lifespan after I retire, and I will be guaranteed to get that money the rest of my life, but if I die before 10 years is up, whatever's left will go to whoever I say it should go to. So I can choose for 20 years as a guarantee. Again, if I die within 2 years, then the remaining 18 years go to whoever I designate will get that. I can also choose a two-life policy. When I choose the one life, I can choose, I think, either mine or my spouse's. If my spouse, in my case, would be younger, then the benefits will be lower. It's just which lifespan they choose to do it on. If I choose two life, if I'm in a civil union, then they will do the actuarial assessment of both of us, and it will continue to be paid. Again, it's got a 10 or 20 year guarantee, but it'll be continue to be paid to whoever survives until death. So both people have to die before the benefits stop. What you get each year is lower because the probability is they're going to end up paying out more. But it's probable that he chose the one life election, and I'd need to know more legal stuff, and then I'd ask, which I don't, and then I'd ask about how long they were married. It would, because he may have made that election before. And the requirement for a signature by the spouse is about 3 years old now. Maybe even less than that. Anyway, the federal law has changed on pensions, and I could have assigned mine and cut my wife out entirely, but now I can't. So if he died more than 2 or 3 years ago, it was possible that he could do that. Now you can't. Now half of it's going to go to your spouse, regardless of who you want it to go to. So unless the spouse agrees. So it keeps people from cutting their spouses out. And there are enough nasty people around that change in the law was a good thing. If you're married, the kid is yours, if it's born while you are married. So if you're the guy and she has a child and you're legally married when the child is born, even if you only got married last week, you're the father. Period. Unless you protest immediately and ask for a parentage determination. And then you pay for the DNA test. If it proves you can't be the father, then you have grounds for divorce and you can get out. If you wait and behave as if you were the father, then you can't later choose that course. Unless within a few days after you file for divorce you raise an objection to parentage, then you can do it. But it's a very narrow window. But if you behave as if you're the child's father, then even if you find out years later that you may not be, you are the father legally and you will support the child until 18. Yes. The question is, does that mean step-parents have no legal obligation to provide support for the biological children of the other parent? That is true. Universities in calculating financial aid don't take it that way. They assume that step-parents will provide something. Right. Yeah. If you're not married, the biological father, unless you're identified at the beginning, or when the parents divorce, those are the two windows as I understand it. Biological dad gets off scot-free. Newspaper this morning. See the Free Press? Local case. 35, 36-year-old man had sex with a 15-year-old, consensual. She got pregnant. He got charged with sexual assault because she wasn't 16. 16 is the age of consent in Vermont. And there's something about the age of the father, but since he was more than twice her age, it was clearly sexual assault. And so he was convicted of that. And now wants visitation rights with the child. And the judge turned him down. He's appealing to the Vermont Supreme Court because it was consensual sex. He said he was stupid. He didn't know, he should have known that if she wasn't 16, she couldn't consent because he was too old. But he still wants to be a father. So he's appealing that ruling to the Supreme Court. What? No, they didn't interview her for the article. That was my question, too. I wonder how she feels. I don't know. Yes. If she said she wanted him to have a relationship with their son, and she supported that, I'm sure the judge would grant it. I'm sure a judge would, maybe the Supreme Court. The other, just one more piece. The other direction in which things are important is that if a man claims parentage, even if you're not married, and he claims to be the father and wants to support the child, that's likely to be granted. He can request that he be proven to be the father and pay for a DNA test, and if he is and wants to assert his parentage, then he's likely to get that. So you have to be careful who you sleep with. Okay, we'll go on from there on Wednesday.